This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Doug Hamilton is on medical leave. Joining me now is Christiana Pond. She is the navigator of a new program called Kinship ND. This is a program that is designed to help provide short-term support for caregivers. Christiana, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
What do you mean by the term short term?
So short term is essentially just the fact that we're here to help them find resources and information that they need to be successful as caregivers. Essentially, it could be helping them get guardianship. It could be helping them understand an IEP for school. But we're not a program that has a long-term case management. Like, we're not constantly checking in. We're here as the caregivers need us.
What is the definition of caregiving under your department?
A caregiver is a North Dakota resident who is a relative, a member of a tribe, a godparent, stepparent, or any other adult who has a relationship with the child and is providing full-time care of the child.
Now, you said related to the child or have a relationship with the child. Why is that important to the Kinship ND program?
Well, you can absolutely be a relative, but you don't have to be. If you have a pre-existing relationship with the child, that helps. It removes trauma. So you could be the mother's best friend and the child has grown up calling you their aunt, but you don't have to actually have any blood relation to the child. Okay. It's just having that pre-existing relationship because it helps the child go to somebody that they're comfortable with, and it's going to help reduce the stress of moving to a different home.
What are some of the signs of the stresses, or you use the word trauma, that can show up in a kid who has to be removed from the home that they know?
Trauma varies dramatically on how it shows with each child. It's tough to give a definition for that. But realistically, you know, anyone who has to move, it's a stressful event. Even if you're a fully grown adult, it can be stressful moving. And so we're just trying to help the children through that process.
Yeah. Have there been cases that have grown specifically out of the pandemic?
At this time, it completely varies as to, you know, why a child is placed out of the home. I would say the pandemic could be a slight factor, but realistically, there are so many different factors as to why children have to be in a different home.
How many families is this program serving right now?
Currently, we are over 70 and constantly growing every day.
Wow. How many can you accommodate? I imagine there's some funding, but that on some level you can't accommodate, you know, thousands of families.
I am hoping to accommodate as many as we need assistance for. If people need that assistance, I want to help them. So sky's the limit for me at this point. We don't have a hard ceiling on how many we can accommodate.
Okay. Where is the funding for this coming from?
The funding is coming from the Children's Bureau as a result of the Family First Preservation Services Act.
What is the process like for reaching out to you to apply for this support?
The process is actually very simple. A caregiver can send me an email at kinship@nd.gov, just saying that they're interested in the program and they would like more information. I can call them and tell them more information. We can discuss things one-on-one, or I can send them the application with the brochure. It's entirely up to them. But if they are interested, they do need to apply. It is a simple application process that can be done digitally. We've got an application that's a PDF, and they can fill it out on their computer, no need to print, and they just email it back to me. Mm-hmm. I go through it, and once I've reviewed it, I call up the caregiver, and we have a one-on-one discussion about their needs and how we can best assist them.
You said you go through it. I imagine there's some kind of screening.
I do need to make sure that they actually have kinship children.
Okay.
But it's going through it in advance to see what their needs are so that, you know, I'm not wasting their time on a phone call, because they have very limited time, of course. They're taking in additional children. And so it's just making sure I know all of the facts that are in the application ahead of time, mm-hmm. so that when I'm working with them, I can provide them the best and most accurate assistance without kind of looking and dilly-dallying and going, oh, what's this?
Sure. So what are some of the most common needs that the caregivers, you know, especially all of a sudden go, oh, yeah. All of a sudden, I'm a parent, and I didn't think about fill in the blanks here.
Yeah, it completely varies based off of caregivers. I've had caregivers who are grandparents, and they're like, nope, I've already raised kids. I'm pretty good on this. I just need a little bit of financial assistance or child care assistance. And then I have other caregivers where they're like, never raised a kid in my life, only babysat. Okay. I need parenting tips, like where should they be developmentally at this stage, or what are chores that are acceptable for their age? And so it completely varies by caregiver need. And that's part of what the program is we help with each unique need that they have.
And I saw online that it's up to $300 for groceries and for clothing. There can be some help with budgeting and, like you said, the parenting strategies, but also an understanding of, and you mentioned this already, the IEP, the Individual Education Plan. What is that?
Mm-hmm. So the Individual Education Plan is generally something that is set up in our school systems to help children who may need a little additional assistance. They may be having a learning struggle.
Okay.
And so this is something that, you know, not everybody understands. They may not have needed to have an IEP when their children were going through school. Okay. And so it's a whole new world. And sometimes it's just helping people interpret, okay, it means your child gets to have, you know, a little extra assistance with this area or that area.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of the job, is helping them understand everything that they may have any kind of confusion with. You know, if it's something I don't know, I'm going to look it up and we're going to work on it together and find out the information that they need to help them be successful.
Sure. A lot of this help here falls under that structural and very practical category, $300 a month to help pay for food. What about the mental health component of both the caregivers and the children, the combination of, oh, I've never parented before, and all of a sudden they're in this incredibly stressful situation, or even just, sure, they've parented, but taking in this kid with the implication that their parents are in currently just not able to care for them, that can be a stress. Are you able to provide any of that level of support?
We have different agencies that we are collaborating with in the state. And so if somebody says, I need counseling, or the child needs counseling, then we will absolutely look at where they're located in the state and try to find the best resources available. Part of the reimbursements for the child need can absolutely go towards counseling assistance, just to help out with that if they do not have any medical insurance that can help with it. And we also try to help them sign up for something like Medicaid, which may be able to assist. I'm a listening ear. I'm not licensed in any way, but I am a listening ear for them.
I think I implied in a question earlier that it was part of this program's job to be placing the children within the home. But just to clarify here, your program is not doing that. Your program is absolutely designed at the support once they've already become caregivers.
Correct.
Okay.
We do not help with placement.
What is your absolute, you know, build a castle in the sky here, dream of growing this program?
Absolute dream is that every kinship caregiver knows that there is some sort of assistance and that they're not alone. We have so many families where they feel completely alone and don't know other people who are going through similar situations. And so I would love to connect caregivers so that they know they're not alone and all of them are able to find resources and assistance to help them be successful and to help them with the children who ultimately are the ones that need the help.
Christiana Pond is the navigator for the Kinship ND Project, which is part of the North Dakota Human Services Children and Family Services Division. This is to provide support for caregivers, and you can find out more at kinshipnd.com. Christiana, thank you so much for your time today.
Absolutely. Thank you again for having me.
Coming up next on Main Street, a preview of the upcoming Great American Folk Show.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor Broker with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck, buying, selling, investing, and estate planning. Information can be found at BillDeanHomes.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Karen Dalton is maybe the greatest singer you've never heard of. But the unorthodox style and complex phrasing of the late 60s, early 70s folk, blues, and jazz vocalist struck a chord and got passed down by many musicians. She started out in the same scene as Bob Dylan, who called her his favorite singer. Later, Adele cited her as a discovery and influence. Karen Dalton died of AIDS-related complications in 1993. Coming up this Sunday on the Great American Folk Show, Irish duo The Breath cover one of Karen Dalton's most known songs, and one that was later reinterpreted out of some lost lyrics. You'll hear a bit of that as lead singer Raina Connolly gets to the heart of what makes Karen Dalton's voice and life story unique and heartbreaking.
But the strongest river, ooh, can't flow uphill.
Hello, this is Raina Connolly. I'm a singer with The Breath and an avid Karen Dalton fan.
I kept on living in my own dream.
I think what I love most about her is the texture of her voice. I really love to hear the imperfection of it.
Out of all the idle scheming, and we have something to feel.
And there's a real beauty in that kind of coarse, gritty, full of character, full of lived experience. There's something really no-nonsense about it.
The last days we had of one another will have to do.
And of course, if you've got any empathy in your heart at all, you're going to hear suffering in her phrasing. You're going to hear anguish. You're going to hear lament. You're going to hear all of those feelings that connect you to the world. She had this beautiful way of making you lean in. She had this unique voice, but her style and her technique were also really one of a kind. Phrasing is everything, you know, but if you sing softer, you'll make the audience lean in to hear it, and that's what she made everybody do. I love to hear that. It's clever, you know. She's a bit of a song stylist. I love the real mischief when I hear her. You know, in her phrasing, like the band has to follow her.
How sweet it is to be loved by you.
So, as it should be, but in many session instances, the singer is singing to the band rather than them having to accompany. You can hear this. It's on quite a few of the tracks on the records. You know, there's a push and a pull as they try to corral her. And her phrasing just, you know, kicks them back into line. She's like some sort of wild mountain goat, you know, it's untamable. And it makes me chuckle. Like, I could be projecting here, but it feels like she's trying to teach them a thing or two as well. It's really entertaining listening to it anyway. Apart from interpreting folk songs, I think she was a conduit for most other writers. You know, she sings songs that you've heard before, but they're just in a whole new light. There's a different tone to them, almost being able to put things on their heads like that. I think for me that's the most important thing about what we should talk about when we talk about Karen Dalton. Like her style, her phrasing, the tone of her voice, what she makes you feel when you hear it. Those are the most important things. Those are the things that should reflect her artistry, not this tragic narrative that we all hear, you know. But if you want to dance, like if you want to talk about that, like apart from, you know, the fact that a man at the time of the same ilk as her would have been heralded as rebellious, you know, rock and roll, free thinking. I do think that women in general were objectified, and still are to a certain extent. You know, and what you can be advertised as, what you can be sold as. And most women on the scene, they were either really pure, they had a bird-like quality to them, some innocence, and those high, clean notes. Or they were projected as anarchic and hard and drinkers, people who indulged. And I think men didn't get tarred with the same brush. You think that the music industry was still quite conservative back then. But if a woman is independent, she's castigated sometimes as having loose morals. She's outspoken. She's wild. If she takes drugs recreationally, she's inferred as a junkie. She's intransigent or on tour on the time, she's projected as likely to disappear on a whim. That was a quote. She's likely to disappear on a whim. You know, so she was kind of projected as someone that couldn't be dependable, and just doesn't ring true for me. I hear a strength in there, you know, of really knowing herself and maybe reading the situation and not trusting it. You know, and that comes from, you know, your own trauma and your own story, but in her voice I find great catharsis. It guides you through certain feelings yourself. I think that music does have that psychic ability. You know, there is, however, some harrowing loneliness pervading in her lyricism. Although she could have been talking about colonialism, she could have been talking about the societal pressures of the time. What's most important is that she actually was writing. It just wasn't being documented. And it only came out after she died. One of my favourite rumours about her was that her mother, who's Native American Cherokee, slept on a brass bed in the garden. But in reality, it was quite a distant relative. Her father was an electrician, though he was a drinker, and her mother was a nurse. What I can kind of back up in my head is that she would have been judged at the time, like she would still be judged now. You know, she was a young mother. She had her first child at 15 and divorced. Married again and had her second child at 17, and then she ran away at 19 to New York with only one of the children that she could get. And that's kind of quite harrowing to me, because I see a 19-year-old still as a child. I know that I left home quite young, but I moved to another country, came to England when I was 19. And I still look at that 19-year-old and I can't imagine, you know, two children and two divorces under my belt already to arrive in a city like New York and try and make it. So I do tip my hat to her, but also with compassion, because it can't have been easy. And of course it would make sense that then her writing would reflect that terrible guilt, the taboo, the shame. You know, the injustice of it being okay for some and not for others. Yeah, it can have been easy. But her writing does reflect that. And it's with great privilege that you can reinterpret those lyrics yourself. Well, we've only tried. Can only try. We're never going to do her justice, are we? How can you do that after they've already gone?
That was The Breath with Karen Dalton's Remembering Mountains, a song reimagined from lost lyrics many years after her death. Karen Dalton died of AIDS-related complications in 1993 and never achieved the commercial success that matched the critical acclaim. You can find out more about The Breath and stream their Karen Dalton covers by going to thebreathmusic.com. And hear more of The Great American Folk Show with Tom Brosseau this Sunday at 5 o'clock Central on Prairie Public.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's road construction season is going very well.
This current drought that we're experiencing in North Dakota, you know, it's tough on the farmers and the ranchers. You know, so I understand the struggles and worry that they're going through. But when it comes to highway construction, you know, the dry weather is actually allowing many of our projects to progress quicker than usual.
Phil Murdoff is the state construction engineer for the North Dakota Department of Transportation.
We're right on schedule and even ahead of schedule to some extent on some projects. So things are looking pretty good.
Murdoff says he believes the majority of drivers are obeying the slower speed limits through construction zones. He says it's something they need to remind themselves of as they travel the state.
There are many times there's often changing conditions in our work zones. you know, oftentimes there may be stop traffic, different driving surfaces, narrow lanes, you know, things like that. And for these reasons, you know, we need to pay special attention when traveling through these work zones, because obviously there's it's not only for the safety of the workers in the work zone, but also the safety of the people traveling through it.
Murdoch says DOT is spending between $350 and $400 million on projects around the state. State and federal health officials are urging parents to make sure their children are up to date on vaccinations before they go to school this fall. Jenny Galbraith is immunization surveillance coordinator for the North Dakota Health Department.
I'm not sure that we can say it's all because of COVID, but we did notice that our routine childhood immunizations did kind of drop a little bit in our percents of coverage.
Galbraith says for kindergarten students, the rate dropped by about 2%. She says right now it's a good time for parents to consider getting their children back into the clinics.
Not only immunizations, but even just a well child visit to make sure everything's still going okay. We know a lot of people didn't go into the clinics, didn't see their medical provider at all for their children during this time, and it's still a really important thing to have that visit and to get immunized so you're protected against other diseases, not just COVID.
Galbraith says many North Dakota schools will begin their fall semesters in August. And outdoor power sports dealers say they're having trouble keeping up with demand for off-road vehicles. Minnesota-based Polaris says the pandemic fueled the desire for socially distanced recreation, fueling that demand for the company's side-by-sides, which look like futuristic dune buggies. Polaris Off-Road Lines Marketing Director Pam Kermish.
We track very closely repurchase rates, and we're seeing growth beyond historical levels. So we do believe there are signs that point to this is going to continue to grow.
Minnesota's Department of Natural Resources says it is working to increase awareness of the importance of staying on managed trails to reduce the environmental damage from riding these power vehicles into the woods. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Certainly you would want water available to fight a fire, but not so much water that you'd want to swim in it. In this week's Plains Folk essay, historian Tom Ezern takes us swimming under the fire hall.
Jerry Kellen started on his contract at the fire hall this week, says the Langdon Courier-Democrat of 18 January 1894. He will put in a brick cistern of 1,000 barrels capacity. Dynamite was used in breaking up the frozen earth. Langdon was getting with the times by constructing a community fire hall, complete with a cistern, a reservoir excavated under the building for water to fight fires. The source of water must have been uncertain because in 1898, the mayor donated his salary of $100 to drill a well and install a windmill next to the fire hall to fill the cistern. How was the water to be deployed? A steam engine and pump were installed in the fire hall to pump into hoses run out to the scene of the fire, literally run out by athletic young men pulling hose wagons into place and trailing lines of hose. We read in 1904 that they responded to a fire at the livery barn too late to save the building, although the 35 horses housed therein were extricated safely. Engineer Plummer at the fire hall, says the newspaper, was not long in getting up steam, and within 10 minutes of the first tap of the bell, the department had three streams of water playing on the flames. The writer commended the gallant stand of hose handlers in preventing spread of the blaze. 7 years later, the alarm sounded when the bakery caught fire, and the firemen were early on the scene with two lines of hose laid, and also a chemical engine. Once again, the building was lost, but the fire prevented from spreading. Afterward, the Great Northern Railroad agent kindly allowed the city to refill the cistern from the railroad's water tank. This general arrangement of a cistern dug beneath the fire hall, hoses unwound from it, perhaps for the better part of a mile, to any point in town, and organized companies of volunteer firemen bringing them into play, seems to have prevailed in towns across the prairies. Newspapers record that there was a cistern under the fire hall in Devil's Lake in the 1890s. Botno, in 1903, boasted a new two-story fire hall with offices on the second floor, fire equipment on the first,
and a 3,000-barrel cistern underneath. Hope, in the early 1900s, also had a cistern under the fire hall, as well as another one back of the lumber yard. News reports in 1905 credited McHenry for purchasing a gasoline engine and 1,500 feet of hose to pump from cisterns, putting the city, it says, in shape to fight the fire fins right. By 1908, Hope was bragging that it also had installed a gasoline engine. By 1909, Langdon, too, had converted to gasoline. This seems prudent in order to avoid the delay in getting up steam. Some cisterns were of brick, but at least one early one, that in Pembina, was cement, as was the one in Ashley, where I first became aware of this sort of arrangement. In fact, I led a research party to Ashley last week to document its historic brick fire hall, constructed in 1912, and also the cistern, called by local citizens the reservoir, underneath it. Our hope is to nominate the hall to the National Register of Historic Places, and so we have to be able to explain how this reservoir business functioned. The entire basement under the fire hall constituted the reservoir, its walls plastered with a concrete plaster containing some sort of sealant. Oral tradition recounts that volunteer firemen were initiated by making them descend the ladder into the reservoir and swim its length. The Ashley Fire Hall Reservoir was utilized for firefighting until the 1940s, when city water lines were installed. After that, it was a storm shelter and, judging by the canned goods still sealed therein, a fallout shelter. As we form up the rest of the narrative, I'll be back with the full story of this historic landmark of McIntosh County.
Tom Easern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Coming up next, Sue Balcom.
On Prairie Public Primetime TV tonight.
Do you remember when we used to play and sing all our favorite songs?
I am Abraham Tabares Jr., and I'll be on the next Prairie Musicians performing new songs off my latest album and some other favorites as well. Join me then.
Watch Prairie Musicians tonight at 9 Central, 8 Mountain on Prairie Public.
Arts programming on Prairie Public is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, a state agency developing, promoting, and supporting the arts in North Dakota.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is root cellar Sue. Sue Balcom joins us once a week to talk about food. She joins us from her farm outside of Mandan, the root cellar's farm. Thank you, Sue.
Hey, thanks for having me.
So this is the time of year where we've done all the hard work of planting and we can't yet do a whole lot of harvesting. Certainly some things have already been harvested, but you can't just sit there and take a break because this is when the insects say, ooh, the eating has gotten real good around
right,
here.
Right, and why wouldn't they? You know, the gardens are green, everything's blooming, they're buzzing around going, yeah, what should we start with?
I'm currently feeding a small family of woodchucks and a raccoon.
Oh my gosh. And you live within the city limits, so you can't shoot them, can you?
Well, also, I'd have no aim. So,
yeah, my husband told me not to shoot at the deer out at our house because if I hit one, it's against the law. I'm like, what do you mean if I hit one? Jeez. Okay. Well, we won't use lead as pest control. Okay. We're going
to
go with some
Did
more natural things. Shoot animals?
No, lead. Oh, okay.
You get it? Lead bullet.
Okay, yeah, I haven't had enough coffee today. I gotcha.
Either
that you're talking about like when we painted radium
on
watches.
No. But that reminds me of that story about, okay, so first of all, we're looking at, you know, all kinds of insects and maybe some fungal activity going on in your garden now.
Yeah.
And so we're going to talk a little bit about that. But I remember when I did all those interviews with the Germans from Russia ladies and they're like, yeah, my mom used to sprinkle flour on the cabbages to get rid of the cabbage moths. And I'm like, really? That
wasn't it
works?
Arsenic?
It had Paris green mixed in it. Remember?
Right.
It was a carrier for that. And I'm just thinking, Yeah. You're a kid and you're out there. I'm sure you got your fingers in your mouth. And yeah, boy, it's a miracle any of us survived. You know, we weren't careful about anything when I was a kid. It was like, get out of the house, do something.
Yeah. Don't go in a car seat, whatever
so,
you do.
Right.
And, so what are you putting on some of your produce right now to protect it?
Okay. One of the things that happens now about this time of year, especially with the high heat and the humidity, is that you get either downy or powdery mildew on squash and cucumbers. So any of those kind of hairy leafed plants. Mm-hmm. And the first thing you have to do before you treat anything in your garden is inspect it carefully, because you need to know what it is that you're trying to get rid of in order to get rid of it. And if you do not know, I happen to know that extension agents are very well versed about these things. So you either take a picture of what the damage to your leaves or your fruit is, or you actually can cut a leaf and take it into their office. And usually they can give you some advice about whether it's a bug eating your leaves, mm-hmm. or like this powdery mildew stuff, which is kind of like a fungus. And it makes your leaves white, you know, like somebody maybe sprinkled flour or Paris green on them. but the cucumbers are the ones that most likely right this time of year, like in July and early August, that are affected by this. Part of this is the humidity in the air that kind of causes this to happen. And so what I have done is actually, instead of using any kind of something that you have to buy. And one of the reasons why we're as organic as we are is because I'm cheap. I don't like to go to the store and buy things that cost, you know, $25 a box to spray on your cucumbers. And this is squash, too. There is something called copper fungicide that does work if you have, like, if you haven't noticed. See, you should go out to your garden every day, every morning, and commune with your plants and look for insect or mildew or whatever damage to your plants, because you've spent all that time mm-hmm. getting them in the garden.
Right.
You don't have to weed anymore, because most of my plants are bigger than any mm-hmm. weeds. I can't find the weeds anymore out in
right.
my garden.
So what are you putting on then, besides the copper fungicide?
So I will use copper fungicide only if it's gotten out of hand, which is why I suggest that you go out and look all the time. But if you take a gallon of water and mix baking soda, 3 tablespoons of baking soda in there, mix it up really good so it doesn't clog your little hand sprayer. You can put a tiny little bit of dish soap in there. As you know, water washes your clothes, not the detergent. The detergent just takes that cohesive emulsifying effect of water, you know, like when you pour water in a cup and it has a bubble over it, kind of.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
if you put a little bit of dish soap in there, couple to bust up your water, and then a tiny little bit of cooking oil, vegetable oil preferred, will help this mixture stick to your leaves. So you spray it on the top and bottom of your leaves, and every time you water, if you water overhead, you'll be washing that off. So you want to respray that. But cucumbers and tomatoes and things that have those furry leaves, they really don't like to be watered from the top. They like to be root watered, which is why we use drip irrigation on them.
So I know for people who are using herbicides, you want to be careful not to do it on too windy of a day or too hot of a day.
Too humid of a day.
Do you run into any of those same concerns with this method?
No, because this is pretty much harmless. Like, you could probably drink this baking soda and water, unless you use river water
I
do.
Which
soap
and cooking oil,
that sounds
terrible.
You could drink.
You wouldn't die, but it's not
right,
a good idea.
Right, and there's not a lot in there. If you're looking at a gallon of water, you've just got teeny tiny little bit of stuff there. But part of what you need to do also, if you're like me and you see a little bare ground, you put something in it, right?
Mm-hmm.
So get out there and make sure that your cucumbers are either trellised or that they're getting lots of wind activity. Get out there and shake them up a little bit. That helps to pollinate them too. But if you have a continual problem with powdery mildew, you are planting your cucumbers probably too densely.
Okay. How about slugs?
Oh, yeah, my favorite. You know what I love about slugs? I don't think you can kill them, little buggers. Like, my kids will touch them. They will not touch them. Mm-hmm. I had a garden in Mandan that was built. The house was built over where everybody had in the late 1800s put all of their grass clippings and things on this empty lot. Then they built a house in there in 1930 or 1928, somewhere around then. So I had slugs up the wazoo in that garden. So I would have them go out and pick them. You can hand pick those little buggers. But we put them in a baking pan that I was going to throw out anyway, and we covered them with gasoline and lit them on fire, and they just...
That does not sound like organic gardening, Sue.
They just froze up. They were little lumps of white stuff, and I would bet dollars to donuts when we threw them into the garbage can, they came out of there. I swear,
so you're telling me there's no way to get rid of slugs.
One of the things you need to do, if you have a bad slug problem, you can do the beer... Mm-hmm. In the pan that's
like
level.
In a shallow dish.
In like a pie tin.
Okay.
And bury that. That really does work. They are attracted to beer.
Yeah. You'll also get poets coming to your yard.
You don't want to mulch. If you have a slug problem because you have too wet atmosphere, too wet soil all the time, they love that. They love crawling under that mulch. So you shouldn't mulch in a garden that has excessive slug activity. Other than that, you can sit out there and pour salt on their little backs if you choose to, because they don't like that very much.
I can't imagine why not.
And then get those vines up off the ground, you know, like trellising,
staking. This is like everything I'm doing wrong in the garden.
Oh,
good to know.
Yeah, you've got to have – they don't like to be in the sun and they don't like dry soil. Another thing you can do if you're collecting eggshells, you can rinse your eggshells and keep them in your house and then crush them up and spread them all over the ground, because that hurts their little bellies when they have to crawl across the eggshells. And I have no sympathy for slugs.
How about hornworms? How do you feel about them?
Well, you know, they're beautiful. Do you get hornworms where you are?
I have absolutely no idea what they look like.
Oh, my gosh. They're like a fat...
Do they have horns?
Yes, they do. They're like a fat, beautiful green caterpillar. I mean fat like a thumb. And they do have a horn on... I can't tell which is the front or back of them necessarily. If the horned part is on the front or the back. But there's a visible horn that they have. And they are... bigger than a tomato stalk. I mean, like, they're a huge worm.
Oh, yeah, I just Googled a picture of these. I have
yes.
seen these, not in my own yard. I've seen, like, small kind of caterpillary things, but definitely nothing this big.
I've only found one in my entire life. But then, purely by accident, I allow the herborage that I plant prolifically
sure.
grows the second and third and fourth year and spreads. That is said, if you let that grow amongst your tomatoes, which that's what I have with my tomatoes now, it does two things. It discourages those worms, those caterpillars, but it also attracts pollinators, which I just haven't seen a lot of this summer. But every time I see a bee, I'm like, go get your friends. Come on. You can do it. So, that's good. That's a good thing to do. So sometimes it's a good thing to leave things grow in your garden, even though you might think that it's a weed, or you might think that it's not helpful.
It's like part of an ecosystem.
Right. And so my horsetail, that is a prime example, because I was like, I don't know what this stuff is. It came in when our property was flooded. It looks like a pine tree sometimes. There's three different kinds of horsetail in stages. You know, sometimes it looks like a little pine tree. Sometimes it looks like a pop bead plant, you know. But I've decided that it is now my friend instead of my enemy, because you can make a horsetail tea that you can spray on fruit trees, grapevines, vegetables, especially roses. And you don't need a lot of dried horsetail to make, you simmer some in a cup just like you would tea. And then you put it in one of those sprayer things, and just it won't hurt anything. But if it gets rid of that mildew and that fungus that grows on your plants, they'll be happier.
You know, I had a conversation with horticulturist Ron Smith once about certain chemicals not working on Creeping Charlie. And ultimately he said, you know, with Creeping Charlie, you just have to become friends with Creeping Charlie. That was the only method.
Yeah, all you can do is kind of just keep pulling it out and covering it up with plants so that you're, like, not noticing it. You know what's really weird this year is the purslane. I have personally, and that's as big as plates out there. Like, it just
well, good
grows
thing
and
it's
spreads.
A good salad edition.
It is. Yeah. I should probably try selling some of that.
You know, we don't have a lot of issues with bunnies in our yard because we have an indoor outdoor cat. Now, that's not going to help me with slugs and whatever, but I have heard that chickens and maybe guinea hens, and in places where that's allowed, which is, you know, on farms and in some cities, like Fargo allows it, but not Moorhead, for example.
Seriously?
Is that true?
Oh, absolutely. I'm convinced that's why I don't have potato bugs, is because we have pheasants and turkeys and other birds, fowl like that. Now, the thing about the chickens is they'll eat your little plants.
Okay.
But I heard that ducks won't. Was it ducks or turkeys won't eat your little seedlings? So mm-hmm. you have to be careful. Make sure that you have your garden completely established. But I totally believe that's why we don't have any of those kind of like somebody said they had cucumber beetles today. And I'm like, let me go home. I know I read something about planting radishes in with your cucumbers or your squash hill and then allowing radishes to go to seed will help ward off some of those insects and bugs.
Hmm.
And I've heard that about radishes for many, many years. And so I never pull – my radishes didn't bulb out this year for some reason. And I thought, I'm just going to let them go to seed because – two reasons. When they bloom – they are a natural repellent for some insects and things, as are onions, which is why I interplanted onions with my cabbage. But those radishes, when they go to seed, have those seed pods on there that are way better than radishes. They're like a tender radish.
Mm-hmm.
They're delicious. I can't wait for those things to grow. So weird year. But lamb's quarter is something, you know, we brought in some sheep manure, and lamb's quarter we've got everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And it's easy to pull out, and I don't ever really mind it. And you can eat it because it's basically
wild spinach. Right? Okay.
But you can grow it. It's good if you allow it to grow in moderation in your garden. It's good for...
Right. Moderation being pretty key, pretty quick with that, though. It will take over.
Right, right. But I allow it, like it likes being... it's stimulated when grown by potatoes, but it's good for cucumbers, pumpkins, and those kinds of things to leave some of that in there. And like last year, my pumpkins and squash, once they started leafing out and vining, nothing stood a chance underneath those leaves. Like, we didn't even know how many pumpkins we had till after the first frost. So my advice today is cut back on your weeding, sit down in your coffee chair by your nearest cucumber plant, and have a good, quiet time with your garden.
More weeding, less reading. No, other way around.
More.
Less
more,
weeding, more
reading.
Weeding. Yeah, I know how to talk.
Yeah, blah, blah.
We check in with Sue Balcom once a week. Thanks, Sue.
All right. Thanks, Ashley.
Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, a consumer-owned generation and transmission cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with over 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
Next time on The Pulse, when you get sick because of a virus, your body's defense kicks into gear.
Kill all the infected cells to potentially eliminate any virus from our bodies.
But even if your symptoms are gone, you're feeling better, many viruses find ways to stick around.
They have strategies to stay.
The lasting impact of viruses.
That's tonight at 8 Central here on Prairie Public.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 15th. On this date in 1832, George Catlin wrote to the New York Commercial Advertiser from the mouth of the Yellowstone River, saying, "The health and amusements of this delightful country render it almost painful for me to leave it. The atmosphere is so light and pure that nothing like fevers and epidemics has ever been known to prevail here. Indeed, it is proverbial here that a man cannot die unless he is killed by the Indians. If the cholera should ever cross the Atlantic, what a secure and at the same time delightful refuge this country would be for those who would be able to reach it." George Catlin could not have been more wrong. Disease had made its way through the Upper Missouri River Valley before, and it would do so again. The mouth of the Yellowstone River would become the epicenter of a massive smallpox epidemic only 5 years later, and George Catlin would get blamed for spreading smallpox to Mandans by painting their pictures. Also on this date, but 19 years later, in 1851, artist Rudolf Kurz documented how artists were feared as harbingers of pestilence, noting how Catlin, along with artist Carl Bodmer, had been blamed for spreading disease. He wrote that the Mandan and Hidatsa look with dread upon an artist as the forerunner of pestilence and death. In 1858, painter and photographer Carl Weimer attempted to take pictures of Hidatsas with his ambrotype apparatus. He wrote, "As soon as I had planted the camera, they became so incensed that they aimed their arrows at my person, which, you may imagine, caused me to immediately desist from further effort. I was informed afterwards that it was the belief of these Indians that had I secured their portraits, they would have perished with the smallpox." There was a kernel of reasoning behind this falsehood. In October of 1832, Dr. Meredith Martin vaccinated Lakotas against smallpox. This was vaccine that Secretary of War Lewis Cass withheld from the Mandans. Meanwhile, George Catlin had been painting pictures of the Mandans for his salvage ethnography project. When an epidemic subsequently struck the tribe, the association with the portraiture was all too easy to imagine. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Andrew Alexis Varvel. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
Americans who want to cross the northern border may still have to put their summer travel plans to Canada on hold.
You don't want to just open up the floodgates.
But with vaccination rates rising in both countries, some people are calling for border restrictions to change.
I'm just frustrated. You know, lack of communication and the lack of a plan.
On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Thursday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, critical race theory has been around for about 40 years, but recently it's been drawing a lot of criticism. We are going to learn about that with North Dakota United President Nick Archuleta. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.